Good evening. We are on here on June 24th, 2008, for the class 35 in the Then and Now series. This evening, the subject matter is the five paths. There's a the need to feel that one is making progress in whatever endeavor one is doing in the human condition is very widespread, very deep pattern, it seems, and it consistently shows up in virtually everything. So we shouldn't be too surprised that it shows up in the spiritual practice. And in the Theravadin tradition, we have the four stages of arhats, the stream winner, once returner, no returner, and arhat. And in the Mahayana, we have the five paths and 10 stages. The five paths of spiritual development or maturation, the 10 stages of the Bodhisattva. And the Dzogchen tradition, which says there are no paths or stages, but we have the 16 stages of Dzogchen. And Mahamudra tradition, we have the four stages of Mahamudra. And if you look at the Full Awareness of Breathing Sutra, there are, I think, 16 stages in there or something. So all of these provide different maps. And, of course, no single individual follows the map or progresses nice methodical way through them, because growth cannot really be systematized, and each person develops in their own way. Still, we have this tendency for organizing things into a progression, and it creates certain problems and provides certain advantages. Among the problems it creates is the idea that if I'm not going through these stages, then something wrong. Something is going wrong. And excuse me. Among the benefits is that you have a map. So you have it gives you some indication of what the next effort might be. Now, this chapter is one of the shortest, and if I hadn't been ill, I might have combined it with the 10 stages of bodhisattvahood, which is a similar map, but with the emphasis on the emphasis is a little different. But I want to. There's some comparison work that I want to prepare for the 10 bodhisattva stages, which I haven't had a chance to do yet. So I'll prepare that for next week. What are the five paths? Well, they're given different names. The first is called the path of accumulation. And the idea is that it's where you accumulate the resources. And as it says on the, Kenchuk Jodson's translation on the bottom of page 257, why is this called the path of accumulation? Because that one gathers the accumulations of virtue in order to become a vessel for the realization of heat and so forth. And then over the page, you see that we start into a whole bunch of lists. The five paths are organized around what are known as the 37 factors of awakening, which goes quite far back in the history of Buddhism, as far as I can tell, and is another effort or attempt to organize or describe progression in practice. Thank you. So please don't think that one develops the mindfulness of the body and then feelings, mind, phenomena, and then develops the four types of perfect abandonment and then the 4 feet of miracle powers and so forth. It's just not linear like that. Another difficulty, in my mind anyway, that the five paths create is the descriptions are often so dramatic that you think, gee, I'll never get out of the starting gate. Some descriptions, when you have 24-hour stable attention, then you've achieved the lesser stage of the path of accumulation. Well, I don't see that happening in my lifetime. But if we forget the notion, or just put aside the notion that this is a linear process and you're going to proceed methodically through this, and look at the five paths as simply a way of organizing a lot of accumulated experience and wisdom, then we can make some use of it. So if we look on page 258 in Kenchok Jiaotsen translation, we have the lesser path of accumulation, starting with the four types of mindfulness. Well, the four types of mindfulness, or the four foundations of mindfulness, as they're often called, are descriptions of how stable attention develops. And the first, even though it's called mindfulness of the body, it really refers to being able to stay present in the experience of sensory perception. Then the second foundation of mindfulness is being able to stay present in feelings. Now, here, feelings don't refer to emotions. It would be better to call these feeling tones. Accompanying every sensory experience, there are any of five feeling tones: pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, physical, and mental. And you get one of the first group and one of the first three: pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and one of the second two, the last two, physical or mental. And these are very rapid things. They occur virtually simultaneously with the sensory perception. And they act as a quality of experience which engages the emotional reactive process. Because if it's pleasant, we're attracted to it. If it's unpleasant, we're averse to it. And if it's neutral, we're indifferent to it. So in the Theravadin tradition, for instance, the whole Buddhist path comes down to being able to detect that pleasant, unpleasant, neutral in every moment of experience and not react to it. Now, not reacting doesn't mean suppressing. It means training a sufficient level of attention that you simply don't react. Whether it's pleasantness, a pleasant sensation doesn't elicit attraction, an unpleasant sensation doesn't elicit aversion, and a neutral sensation doesn't elicit indifference. And if one can do that, then one is largely freed from reacting to experience, which is the end of suffering. One of the recent patriarchs of Cambodian Buddhism, Goshananda, I met on a few occasions, and he would speak so eloquently about just this topic, the importance of when anything arose, pleasant, you just experience the pleasantness, but you don't grab for it. Unpleasant, you experience the unpleasantness, you don't push it away. Neutral, you experience that it's a neutral sensation, and you don't fall into a dullness or indifference. As you're able to stay present with those feelings, then you notice much more clearly the emotional reactions of attraction, aversion, and indifference. And that's what the third foundation of mindfulness refers to. Here it's mindfulness of mind. Elsewhere it's referred to mindfulness of emotional states or mindfulness of mental formations or so forth. And at this stage, you start staying present in the process of attraction, in the process of aversion, in the process of indifference. They may arise, but you don't get swallowed by them. Ordinarily, when emotional reactions arise, we regard them as facts, as things we have to act on. And so when we're averse, we push something away, or we suppress it in some way. But this, when you're able to stay present in the emotional reaction itself, then what actually happens is you transform the energy of emotional reaction into attention. And it's quite simple to do an exercise on that. I may have done this with you before, but I think it's worth doing again. Pick something to which you are attracted, something that you like, something that you want. It can be a person, or it can be a thing. It doesn't make any difference. And just imagine that object of attraction in front of you and feel the attraction. Now, as you let yourself feel the attraction, experience how that attraction is expressed in your body, often there will be an inclination to lean forward towards the object. And there may be a feeling around the heart. There may be feelings in the hands or fingers. Just experience how attraction manifests in the body. And when you're able to stay in that, then what are all of the emotions associated with the attraction? There can be a yearning. There can be guilt. There might be shame. There could be anger. There could be joy. So just observe what's there and experience what's there along with the physical sensations. And when you can stay present in that, notice all the stories or experience the stories as well. I deserve this, or I don't deserve this, or if I had this, I would be so-and-so. Or because I don't have this, I am so-and-so. And the stories can take many, many forms. And they're just stories. None of them are really facts. So now you're present in the whole experience of attraction. As you rest in that experience, look now again at the object to which you're attracted. How do you experience it now? And when you're ready, I'd like you to describe that. Is there a change? Chuck?
The object has sort of lost its, to me, it's all of the emotions and everything have taken on the experience of the object, and the object has lost some of its luster.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the object, so by experiencing attraction, you aren't as attracted.
Right, the whole I'm caught up in the feelings of being attracted and not essentially on the object itself.
Yeah, are you really caught up in the feelings, or are you just experiencing the feelings?
I think experiencing.
Yeah, and that's one thing that happens by experiencing the feeling very explicitly, then the pull diminishes.
Right.
Okay. Anybody else? Art?
No, it was exactly the same.
Yeah. Did any of you find you appreciated the object in a more open way?
I think a way I could explain it is I no longer need what I desire. I don't desire it any less, in a sense. I mean, I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. That's often people find that there's a kind of appreciation. And the grasping quality of the desire is diminished. Okay. So this is an example of what happens when you're able to stay present in actual emotional reactions, which is what third stage of mindfulness, and it's actually a bit more than that, it's being able to stay present in any functioning of the mind. Okay. Yes?
Because the, for lack of a better word, the positive and negative feelings of attraction or aversion are so familiar, how would you do that with indifference? How does one stay present in...
This is actually what the equanimity meditation, Wake Up to Your Life, is about. Indifference is a kind of ignoring. So here we have a rather dull rug in this room. You know, it doesn't seem particularly exciting, right? So how many experience some kind of indifference with this rug here? How many would just yearn to have this and would be willing to pay top dollar for this rug? How many would of you would go completely crazy if this rug was in your home? So it's not really attraction or aversion. Okay. Now, just experience that indifference. Look at the rug and open to the experience of and how that you may notice that there's a kind of sluggishness or dullness in the body. Are you with me? Okay, so just experience that. And there's a disinterest in the mind, so you just experience that. And among the stories, I don't care, it's not interesting. So you just experience that. What's happened when you move into that, when you move completely into that experience? What happens with your experience of the rug?
It's kind of hard to explain. It's there's a different type of energy or a different type of charge as compared to something to which I'm attracted to. But there is I don't know how to describe it, but there is sort of an energy there that that I can stay with that is neither this nor that. It doesn't seem to have the intensity that the others had. So it's, I could easily sort of see myself going one way or the other with it. It's harder to to stay with that because there isn't the intent for me. Because
but when you go through the process, you know, there's a shift in one's experience in exactly the same way.
Yeah.
And it's no longer boring. Yeah. It's not. It may not be. You may not be attracted to it, or you know, or be excited about it, or anything like that. But your relationship with the experience shifts. Okay, Chuck, you had a question.
I was just going to say that it. Because you aren't ignoring it, it's no longer boring. There is a little bit more of an attraction to it.
Or at least an interest in it.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Okay. The fourth stage of mindfulness is, it's always translated as mindfulness of phenomena. I really think it should be mindfulness of experience. Because phenomena has this notion of what's out there, what you're looking at, whereas this is just what's arising. And when you're and at this level of mindfulness, it doesn't matter what arises. The mindfulness is not not perturbed, or you don't fall into distraction. And so, in this way, attention has now become very, very stable. Then the next, it says these four occur during the middle stage of the path of accumulation. Well, that's just our old the philosophical bookkeeping which these academics were prone to. But let's take a look at these, the four types of perfect abandonment.
You said middle, didn't you?
No, well, I'm on to the middle one. I was just jumped to the end of B. I'm talking about the four types of perfect abandonment, which are said to occur during the middle path of the stage of accumulation. Okay. The thing is that please don't think that this happens sequentially like that. You don't practice the first stage of mindfulness, second, third, fourth, and then you start practicing these. All of these things are going to be practiced. And part of one's experience at every stage of growth and development. We have a translation problem around this word abandonment. It's often just easier to translate this word by the word stop. How things stop. And really, it's a very simple, very straightforward description of how you make significant change. It's very simple. You have a situation. You stop doing those things which make the situation worse. That's the first step. You stop doing things which make the situation worse. No, sorry. I'm sorry. You decrease doing the things which make the situation worse. That's the first stage. The second is you stop doing things which make the situation worse. Third stage is you start doing things which make the situation better. And the fourth stage is you strengthen things which make the situation better. Now, when you put it that way, it's just common sense, right? Here, that particular framework is being applied to our involvement in samsaric experience. What are some things that make samsaric experience worse and deepen our involvement with that? Anybody?
Interacting with other people in general.
You had a bad day, did you?
No, but I feel like that's usually the root of both attraction and aversion, or how I experience other people.
So your solution is very Theravada in this way. You just don't interact with anybody. And
no, I don't think that's the answer.
Okay, so I agree. I don't think it's the answer either. So what can you do to decrease the ways that deepen our involvement with some samsaric experience? And just stopping interacting with people, not terribly practical. So what are some things that make it worse?
That make it worse?
Yeah, it's not the interaction with people that makes it worse. It's the reactive emotions that come up.
Right.
Okay. So, one of the things we can do is to, avoid situations which make us very angry or elicit very strong feelings of neediness or desire. It's one thing you can do. It leads to a more balanced life. You follow?
I do, but I would have to... It sounds ridiculous, but I would have to give up my profession altogether if I were trying to avoid those sorts of situations.
Okay. So what's something you can do?
Me?
Hmm.
That would help me to avoid having reactive emotions with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't have anything that's not like totally sarcastic, like give up coffee or take Xanax.
Well, if you stay up late at night and are very tired when you go to work the next day, are you more or less likely to have strong reactive emotions?
I think it depends on the day.
But generally speaking, when we're tired and cranky and things like that,
it doesn't help.
It doesn't help. So that's an example of things we can do that avoid making the situation, things that we can decrease that make the situation worse.
Right.
And we can look at our lives, you know, we can eat properly, or we can stop eating badly.
Mm-hmm.
We can, and some of the things that make things better is that we can exercise regularly. Maybe we could even practice a little meditation. Shock, and so forth. So this is how we bring about change. And just proceeding in a very simple, methodical way. What's making this worse? Okay, start reducing that until you get to the point that you can actually stop doing all the things that make it worse. And some of the things that make it worse is carrying a grudge. Yes, Randy?
The thing that I do personally that makes everything much worse, and it's chronic and I'm addicted to it and I can't let it go, is thinking about it, making up stories about it. How do you stop thinking?
Well, there was a situation the other day that arose for me in which I asked somebody to do something for me. And I found that I wasn't confident that it was going to happen. And so I started thinking about it, just like you're describing. And my tendency would have been to, after having basically delegated this task to somebody, to call all the people that are connected with it and make sure it happens, which, of course, everybody finds very irritating because they feel like they're being micromanaged, right? So what I did was I just went, well, let's just see what happens. And every time the impulse or the thought came up, oh, I should check on this, or I should send this email, or I should make this phone call, I would just say, that's a thought, and let it go. And didn't act on it. So I was working with my own experience. And and I ended up not doing anything. And everything turned out just the way that I hoped it would and that I had asked for it. Everybody did what they were meant to do. So when you find that kind of thinking coming up, you recognize it as thinking. And you're not going to stop it immediately. But every time you recognize it as just thinking, stuff whirring around, then and you can stay present in that without acting on it, then you take a little bit of momentum out of it. And you do that again and again and again. You actually start operating in a different way. And it's an exact application here. Rather than acting on it, that makes things worse. You stop acting on it. And eventually the juice drains out of it, and then it arises much less. What we tend to want to do is, when we want to change, we just want to just go, make it like a switch, like done. But change doesn't take place that way. What these four types of perfect abandonment, which Yongdak Pyongpa Ji, I'd say the four aspects of thoroughly stopping something has to go through those four stages. First decrease what's making it worse, then end what's making it worse, start things that make it better, and strengthen things that make it better. And that's how change actually comes about. It isn't just like throwing a switch. Does this make sense? Any other questions on this? Now we get into even more technical stuff. The 4 feet of miracle powers. I would be tempted, this is the literal, they're called the 4 feet or 4 legs of miracle powers. I would look at these as supports, you know, because we stand on legs, that through which you bring about, you know, to use their word, miraculous change. Sometimes we look at somebody who does something and say, how did they do that? It seems like a miracle. But if you look a little more closely, very often you'll find that these 4 things are present. There is a very strong aspiration, a great yearning for this to come about. They worked hard at it. That's the perseverance. The absorption of mind is they focused their attention on it. They didn't get distracted. And they were strategic about it. They looked at the situation and figured out what actually needed to happen. And when you bring that kind of attention to things, attention and energy, realistically, there's very little that you can't accomplish. So I hope through this kind of discussion you're getting the idea that these aren't esoteric or mystical or strange things. They're just very straightforward descriptions of what is involved in bringing about change. And one is a stabilization of attention, another is moving things in the right direction. That's what the 4 types of perfect abandonment are about. And then focused, strategic attention accompanied by consistent effort. There's nothing magical here. This is how we make things happen. Now, all of this is being applied to the very specific task of freeing us from samsaric, freeing ourselves from samsaric experience. But they really have much, much wider application than that. Okay. Yeah.
The word absorption, at least to me, connotes a sort of non-effort. A sponge absorbs water. Is there a different word, a better word, what's it trying to say?
Let me see. I wrote a paper on this, which I will probably put up on the websites so that people can download it. And I'm just going to check what the... uh, juice. Here we go. Yeah, this doesn't use the term absorption here. I would suggest that it's probably the word for samadhi, which is a high level of attention. It's not like a sponge at all. Being fully engaged in is the meaning. Yeah, if you could just plug that in, that would be great. Yeah, that's good. My battery lasts about 5 minutes now. Is that what happened to yours?
Not quite that bad, but about half an hour.
Yeah.
Better.
Yeah. I've got to take mine in because it doesn't hold any charge. okay. Now, supposedly, when you've gone to develop all of that stuff, you've completed the greater stage of the path of accumulation. You can see from this is all about developing stable attention to bring to the task of moving out of samsaric experience. In other words, you're not distracted, you're not disturbed by the arising of things. And that's how it's often described in other texts. The second path, the path of what's called here the path of application, I prefer the translation, a path of accommodation. The Tibetan word is jor, which has the meaning of join. And this is where you are joining or going through the process of adapting to the understanding that nothing has any independent existence, which is a very significant shift in the way that we relate to things in the world. And brings up a huge amount of emotional reactivity, but also takes quite a time to adapt to how do you live and function without a sense of self, without a sense of identity, without a reference point. So whereas the emphasis in the path of accumulation is on the stabilization of attention, and we can say shamatha, the emphasis in the path of accumulation is on coming into a deeper relationship with experience, that experience is essentially groundless. In preparation for the third path, which is the path of seeing, here it's referred to the path of insight, but it's usually translated as the path of seeing the nature of things. So you'll see that it has four stages corresponding to the realization of the direct knowing of the Four Noble Truths: heat, maximum heat, patience, and realization of the highest worldly dharma. This is wonderfully complex description of the process through which this understanding evolves. And if you look on Gunther's translation in the footnote here, on page 236, I think that's where it is. There's a process of where there's a direct knowing arises. So you see that the way you see the first, we'll do this in conjunction with the First Noble Truth. And the First Noble Truth says there is suffering. That is, and it's saying this process of reaction is suffering. And so you actually see that. And that's a pretty jarring experience. And so initially there's a lack of acceptance of that. So the second stage is actually accepting, oh, this is how things are. And when we accept that, it allows another level of seeing that this is really how things are. And then we're able to accept that understanding, and that's regarded as the full understanding or knowing that the reactive process is suffering. And you may have observed this in yourselves, that first we get a kind of sense of it, and we resist it, and then we take it in a bit deeper, and then we start actually functioning out of that understanding. And so, and it's a very different way of pursuing life. Do you understand what I mean? And what is being done with these very, very detailed descriptions of these processes is looking what actually happens in us. But then what they do is they turn it around and make it into this system where you have to you go through these four stages here and these four stages here and these four stages here and these four stages here, making a total of 16 stages, etc. And then people have the feeling, oh, I have to do it in exactly that order. And it doesn't really work like that. But if you look at the description of each of these, you can often recognize something in one's own experience. And say, oh, yes, I felt that. Or I've experienced that. And this is why I say these are useful as maps in one sense, but we can also get very, very caught up in these very technical explanations. Now, the heat that's referred to here is not... again, it's a technical term. It is often accompanied by a sense of warmth in the navel area. In the Japanese tradition, it would be called the dantian, or the in the Chinese tradition, I suppose, the hara in Japanese. But it really refers to the beginning of a shift in the way that we relate to experience, and that we're... what arises in experience is less and less other. And there's, more warmth in the relationship. That increases to a point where it becomes maximum heat. There's some difficulty in tolerating that because one's way of experiencing things is shifting here, and so there's a big letting go process. And as you're able to stay in that, then you come to this realization of the highest worldly dharma. I love this. It's as deep as your understanding can go. Or your experience can go without dropping into the direct non-conceptual knowing, which is the path of seeing. So there's still an element of duality here, but it's getting pretty tenuous. When you go through this, when you fully accommodate to functioning without reference, functioning without a sense of self, then you just see how things are. And that's the path of insight. Here, the Joe? I know this sounds all dry and technical. I'm sorry, I'm not making it better.
Well, you directed us towards Gunther's footnote, which has a suggestion in it, which I find troubling, and that is that one must put off acceptance of reality until the moment where the reality one has experienced is the ultimate reality. If one doesn't, one is stuck.
Well, yes, Gunther says that. I haven't seen that really anywhere else, so I think there's a little bit of Gunther in there. So thank you for raising that. There isn't any really sense of putting it off. It's more continuing. Put it this way. If you take, as an example, the question, what am I? You can look and you go, oh, I don't see anything. And say, okay, so that's nice, I'm nothing. And that's kind of an intellectual understanding. But it doesn't change very much. But if you say, okay, what am I? And you look. And you really look very, very deeply, then something very different starts to happen. You begin to experience being nothing. You follow? And so not being satisfied was simply a conceptual understanding. But you keep pushing it and pushing it and pushing it until you actually experience being that. That's what's being referred to here. That make more sense to you?
Yes. This is no particular spiritual flypaper which we come to. And if we keep asking the questions, we can't avoid stopping. I mean, it's not like some mysterious place. Because he suggests that the three classifications of awakened beings are due to this stopping and getting stuck.
Well, what are the Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas?
Yes.
Yeah. This is coming from a Mahayana point of view. And they had to erect these straw guys to make themselves look good. And there is some truth in this. That is, people can look at, take the question, what am I? And come to experience being nothing and say, okay. And so they're freed from a sense of self in that respect. And not be curious about all this whole experience. You know, and they're just not curious about it. In the Mahayana path, we're not only curious about what we are, we're also curious about what all this is. And similarly, when we look at all this, that too seems to be nothing. You follow? Mm-hmm. Or the way Rinpoche explained it to me, the Shravakas come to the realization that, or the direct experience that there is no self. So they're freed from that. They're freed from samsara on the basis of that. And the Pratyeka Buddhas not only understand or know that there is no self, they also know that there is the subject-object duality is false. But it's only the bodhisattvas that understand not only is there no self and the subject-object duality is false, but also what appears as object in our experience is equally as empty as the self. There's simply the arising of experience. And so there are those three levels, and that's probably what Gunther's referring to. But it's a question of how curious you are about experience. And some people stop at different places.
So it might be more fruitful for me particularly to think of them as they are explained a bit earlier in this book or someplace else, mm-hmm. as resting places rather than traps from which you cannot...
I think, yes, it's much better to view them as places where your curiosity stops. And it doesn't mean you're consigned to that or sentenced to it. But again, people have their own spiritual questions. And what I encourage people to do is to take their own spiritual questions very seriously. Time and again, people sacrifice their own spiritual questions for instructions that are given. And this is where they run out of enthusiasm, is because they aren't really meeting their own spiritual questions. If you have your own spiritual questions, you will pursue this until you feel present in life.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, you'll see here we have two more lists, the five powers and the five strengths. And you'll also notice that the five powers and the five strengths have exactly the same elements in each list. The difference here is the degree to which these have developed. And again, I'm not really competent to talk about this, but there's clearly there's a shift that takes place so that for instance, if you take faith, it's something that you can use, but when you move up to the level, move from faith being a power to faith being a strength, I think you can consider an analogy of knowing how to do something. Knowing how to do something, and being competent in it, and on the one hand, and it becoming second nature, on the other. I think it's that kind of difference is being referred to here. Then you get to the the path of insight. Now, the path of insight is kind of a non-path because it occurs only for an instant, and then you're immediately into the path of meditation or cultivation. And by that I mean the path of seeing refers to, and it's given different descriptions, but the way I think of it is where you're the point at which you see the nature of things, and it's not an experience. It's not an energy surge. It's an actual seeing, and it completely screws up all the samsaric functioning in you. And as we'll see, this is the first level of bodhisattvahood, which is called the joyful one. You know, you're really happy now because you see that samsara has absolutely no basis. Everything's empty. And there's a freedom there. As you'll see, he talks about the four insights correspond to each of the four noble truths, making a total of 16. This is where it goes into the eight patient acceptances and eight awarenesses, the eight patient acceptance of the Dharma, which are the eight awarenesses. That's that process that I was describing before. And got it a bit out of place. I'm not quite sure how they got all of that elaborate stuff, but this is where that seeing takes place. And then you're into what's called the path of meditation or cultivation. And what's important here is to understand that when you see the nature of things, nature of experience, nature of mind, whatever you want to call it, there's no difference between that seeing and the seeing that a Buddha is capable of. It's the same. The difference is the degree in which that knowing actually manifests in your life. And that's what the path of cultivation is about, is that it is letting this seeing, this knowing, have fuller and fuller expression in one's life. In the beginning, it just is taking place in one's meditation, but then it begins to manifest in one's life. And that's what we'll be looking at in the next chapter, because that's exactly what the 10 Bodhisattva stages describe, is how that seeing gradually takes expression in all aspects of life. Now, here, the worldly meditation practice, the first, second, third, and fourth meditation stages, and the former stages of, you may recall when you're going through the six realms, we talked about the God realms, the form gods and the formless gods. This is where all of this stuff comes in. What they're describing here are very high levels of resting mind. But they aren't a priori associated with seeing. They're just stable, very, very stable attention. And then in section B, he talks meditation practice beyond the world. This is where you're seeing into the nature of things, or the seeing and the resting occur together. And this is different from just having a very quiet mind. Now, you can begin to see how they're taking all of these different aspects of traditional teachings and trying to slot them into this map of the five stages, and it isn't making a lot of sense. And you get these very elaborate explanations. And this is what happens when you have an academic tradition. People formulate and, you know, take this here, and then say, oh, well, we have this here, and give these very elaborate explanations of how it works. But it doesn't all accord with actual experience. And we have people who, from IKEMA, and Lee Brasington is one person who's doing this now, who teaches courses in the four jhanas, which are exactly what's being talked about in the worldly meditation practice. And these are ways of stabilizing intentions. No mention of the five paths, or this is coming after the path of seeing. No, these are practices you do to develop stable attention. So don't take the order here too seriously. Probably people will think I'm saying horrible things by doing that. You see that you come down now to bottom of section B, and you get the Noble Eightfold Path. And so from this point of view, you can't really start practicing the Noble Eightfold Path until you've understood emptiness. Okay. There's some truth in that. Here they're translating it as perfect view, perfect conception. This is not how I understand the Eightfold Path at all. you may recall and wake up to your life that I talk about. How do you practice right speech? Now, in traditional texts, you'll find that there are the 4 or 16 qualities of right speech. I think the four, I'm not sure I can remember them, but it's truthful, it's kind, it's appropriate, and it's said gently. So you aren't screaming or yelling, things like that. I'm not sure I have those exactly right, but it's something along those lines. And it's appropriate that you don't say, even if it's true and you say it kindly and gently, if it's going to trigger reactive emotions and disturbing things, you don't say it because it's not appropriate. So what people do with that is they take that as a prescription for what they should be saying and how they should be saying it. And so they take it as a rule, and so they always try to speak in a very kind and gentle voice and really think about what they're going to say so that it's true and it's appropriate for the situation. And this is totally in the wrong direction, because now you are engaged in even more thinking and more control of your behavior, if you see what I mean. Contrast that with what happens when you listen to the sound of your own voice when you are speaking. Have any of you tried this? What happens when you do that? Randy?
First, I tend to say less.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer words.
Yep.
And it's more connected with whoever it is I'm talking with.
Mm-hmm. So it's more appropriate. Yep. Mm-hmm. Are you inclined to yell and scream?
No.
No. So what I found is that if I'm paying attention while I'm speaking, then my speech naturally moves to those four characteristics. So I like to regard the Noble Eightfold Path as not doing things perfectly, the way it's described here, but doing things in attention. So, as you speak in attention by listening to the sound of your own voice. And the same thing happens with movement. If you walk in attention, you walk differently. You don't stumble over things. And that refers to action. If your attention is in the action itself, so while you're moving your hand, you are right in that experience, then you tend not to move suddenly or jerkily. You can simply move, you can certainly move quickly if it's called for, but there's going to be a smoothness because your attention is right in the action. And the way that we look at the world, we don't usually bring attention to that. Like, how am I looking at the world right now? But if we start doing that, we start questioning things. And we don't take things for granted. We let go of assumptions. And you may recall from the Four Agreements, one of them is don't make assumptions. So we begin to just be completely open to what is arising. That's moving us into the direction of right view. So if you look at these view, conception, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and absorption, it's our meditation.